And the scene takes place on the Isle of Ely in Cambridgeshire, about 150 miles north of London. It takes place in a castle called Wisbeach Castle. There, in that gloomy dungeon, are 33 Roman Catholic priests. They've all been imprisoned there by Elizabeth I, the Protestant Queen of England. And they've been gathered from dioceses throughout the whole of the British Isles. Their crime was that they refused to accept the new and the false religion of Elizabeth. They refused to accept the new and false form of worship that she tried to foist off on Catholics in Britain. Some of them had celebrated Mass after the Mass had been forbidden, secretly administered the sacraments furtively and privately. And their punishment was to be expelled from the parishes, to be imprisoned without a trial, and to be threatened with the traitor's death, the terrible death of hanging, drawing, and quartering. These 33 diocesan priests were undergoing a living martyrdom for the Catholic faith and for the Catholic Mass. Meanwhile, fellow priests, priests like them, were risking exactly the same fate and the same type of death which they faced. These men, too, were going about in England bringing the Mass and the sacraments to scattered groups of Catholics who remained faithful to their Lord. Among these priests were diocesan priests, like themselves, like the ones in prison, members of different religious orders, some Franciscans, some Dominicans, but principally members of the Jesuit order, men like Father Campion and Father Garnet, who would later themselves undergo martyrdom for the faith. Men like Campion and Garnet had been educated in Belgium and smuggled into England. And like all Catholic priests in England, they were trying to do the work of God. On November 17, 1600, a letter to the Pope was prepared by these 33 priests. It is secretly passed around among them. Each one of them, each one of these heroes for the faith, gravely reads the letter to the Holy Father, nods, and appends his signature to the bottom. A guard is then bribed, and the letter is passed to a Confederate waiting outside Wisbeach prison. The Confederate in turn passes it to a messenger who gallops off into the night and grabs a ship to Europe and then heads off toward Rome. A few months later, the letter arrives in Rome. The Pope's secretary opens the letter. He reads it. He looks at the 33 signatures of these heroes for the Catholic faith, and he sighs to himself. And he says, "Bene, ancora." Great, another one. He takes the letter, puts it over on this huge pile he has on the side of his desk of the rest of the letters he has received from English diocesan priests just like these men. Each and every one of them writing to the Pope to complain about the power-hungry Jesuits who are trying to take over the missions in England. The 33 Catholic priests from Wisbeach, like the rest of the persecuted diocesan clergy in England, were trying to get the Pope to pull the Jesuits out and leave the missions under their control. Well, this wasn't the first time. It was the second appeal that the priests of Wisbeach had made to the papal court. The first had taken place 2 years previously. In 1602, the Pope issued a compromise decision, but the rivalry continued between the Jesuits and the diocesan priests, even in the face of persecution, even in the face of death. In 1629, the persecution abated somewhat. Then what happened is that the conflicts began to come out into the open again between the Jesuits and the diocesans. The Jesuits and the diocesan priests launched suits and countersuits against each other at the papal courts, expended great sums of money hiring canon lawyers to defend their positions. A little later, we read an account by one Richard Smith. He was a diocesan priest who had secretly been made a bishop. Remember, it was a crime punishable by death to be ordained a priest or bishop abroad and to come to function in England. So he entered England in disguise, entered secretly, and went about confirming children, secretly ordaining priests. And in hiding, he writes the following letter in 1631 to a cardinal, who was a friend of his. And after going through all his woes and trials and tribulations, he ends up by saying, "I am shut up perpetually in a small bedroom and can never allow myself to breathe fresh air. I am at the mercy of the plots of the heretics and the harassing Jesuits." In an incident which will perhaps sound familiar to some of us, another incident. There's a very famous place of pilgrimage in Flintshire, in England, called Holy Well of St. Wilfrid. It had been a great pilgrimage place before the so-called Reformation. And Catholics were desirous to go there still, even at the risk of their lives. To accommodate the spiritual needs of these Catholics, the Jesuit fathers set up a secret mass center and shrine for the laity who came to visit the pilgrimage places. This was hidden in a hotel called the Star Inn. The diocesan clergy heard about this and then set up a rival mass center while on the road at the Cross Keys. These conflicts continued until the middle of the 19th century, when the hierarchy was finally restored in England. Some 250 years. The point is that we're used to thinking that before Vatican II, everything was conflict-free in the Catholic Church. We look back to the golden, almost Ozzie and Harriet-like days of 1950s Catholicism, when the angelic pastor, Pius XII, kept everyone in line. And the hierarchy was filled with Spellmans, was filled with Dohertys, was filled with Mundelines. And you never heard, really, a breath of dispute among Catholics. We wish it could be so in our own time, of course, but if we look over the history of the Church, we see that it was not always thus. We can take another example from the pages of the history of the order of which I was a member, the Cistercian Order. Cistercian Order was founded by St. Robert of Malem, St. Stephen Harding, and St. Albrecht in the year 1089. Cistercian Order had many, many great saints. They considered themselves a reform of the Benedictines and set out to live a very strict life according to the rule of St. Benedict. Well, as fate would have it, in the 17th century, as at the same time that the Jesuits and diocesan priests were fighting for the control of missions in England, the Cistercians were at it in France. Now, there was a division in the order between two groups. One group referred to as the ancients or the common observance. The other group was called the strict observance, we call them the Trappists today, or the abstinence. Now, what was at issue was the question of whether or not, according to the rule of our Holy Father Benedict, it would be permitted from time to time to eat meat. The ancients said no and claimed that they were maintaining the order's ancient traditions, and the abstinence said that no, you could not eat any meat at all. Ancients said you could eat meat, abstinence said you couldn't. So a fight ensued, naturally. And the conflict lasted for 100 years. And there's a whole book that's written on the subject. It's absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I picked it up, in fact, in an airport bookstore, of all things. It's called The Rise of the Cistercian Strict Observance in 17th Century France. It's written by Father Louis Lacaille, who is one of the greatest historians of our order. And he says in his book that part of the problem was that the papal decrees couldn't be enforced in France without the consent of the French monarch, the French king. And this was one of the occasions, if you will, for the dispute. So on the side of the ancients, those supporting the ancients were the Parliament of Paris, the Bishop of Dijon, a city in southern France, and the civil government of the city of Dijon, where this is in the area where most of the monasteries were located. On the side of the abstinence, those who did not want to eat meat, was Cardinal Richelieu, and were members of the King's Council. Now, you read through this book, and what do you find? You find that throughout the 17th century, there were endless lawsuits between the two parties, both civil lawsuits, ecclesiastical lawsuits, complaints on both sides of alienation and mismanagement of funds, one side pronouncing the other side's vows invalid and vice versa. There are scenes of locking each other out of elections, monasteries, charges of bad faith, and lust for power. Now, Father Lacaille's book has some very interesting passages. The first we take concerns an election at Citeaux. Now, Citeaux was the mother house of the whole Cistercian order. It was where the order was founded. It was supposed to be envisioned by St. Robert of Milan as the great place of monastic peace. Well, it wasn't in 17th century France, and we read the following account of certain circumstances surrounding an election for the abbot general of the order. It takes place in the year 1643. Early in the morning of January 2nd, 21 members of the ancient or common observance assembled in the chamber of Jean Boucherat, and ignoring the protests of the abstinence, entered the church for the celebration of the Mass of the Holy Ghost to begin the chapter. After the Mass, finding that the abstinence had locked the doors of the definitorium, which was the traditional place where elections were held, they repaired to the chapter hall, pursued by the indignant abstinence. There was, says Father Lacaille, however, no physical violence at this time. Another incident. Charges of bad faith. Always something that's fairly common in conflicts. The point of view of the common or ancient observance was aptly summarized in a letter written shortly after the publication of one of the council's decisions, that's the King's Council's decision. The abbot of Clairvaux, one of the most famous Cistercian monasteries, the monastery St. Bernard was abbot of, the abbot of Clairvaux complained that, quote, hypocrisy, unquote, had prevailed upon the Queen and upon the King's Council for this decision. This was resulting from, and we quote, the whisperings of a certain secular priest, Vincent by name, the greatest enemy of the venerable traditions of the Cistercian order, and most amicably disposed toward the reformers called abstinents, who in reality are wearing merely the mask and semblance of false piety. The certain secular priest criticized for doing this whispering, we know today as St. Vincent de Paul. We find another incident with which perhaps some of us can identify, where the civil authority and the police were actually called. This took place at the monastery of Lanvaux. One of the supporters of the abstinence, Hervé du Tertre, decided to exploit the opportunity at Lanvaux, and on January 10, 1661, dispatched three of his monks to Lanvaux under armed escort furnished by the local authorities. The two stubborn ancients in the monastery were forced to leave. They retreated to Villeneuve, but only there to organize an armed band of sympathetic neighbors. It was with such help that on February 3, the ancients returned to Lanvaux and ousted the reformed monks by force. The indignant Tertre summoned the seneschal, that is to say, the sheriff of Auray, who on February 5th marched with his police force to the abbey and, after scuffling with the ancients, reinstated the abstinence. The perplexed local magistrates attempted to conciliate and suggested that the abbey was big enough to accommodate both observances. But in the atmosphere of increasing bitterness, such solutions were no longer feasible. In fact, Nicholas Paget, the abbot of Villeneuve, thought it was his duty to offer help again to the hard-pressed ancients. Leading some 30 armed men, he rode to Lanvaux and, after a violent scene, threw out the hapless abstinents. Expecting retaliation, the new possessors of the abbey barricaded all entrances and prepared themselves for the inevitable siege. When Tertre returned with his grievances to the Parliament, which reaffirmed the rights of the strict observance over Lanvaux, by the force of this decision, the local military surrounded the abbey on May 6th, and after having broken down doors and windows and climbing through barricaded hallways, both suffering and inflicting some bruises in the melee. Thus, the superior forces prevailing by the end of 1661 were those of the strict observance, and they were in firm possession of the monastic battlefield. Now, this sort of thing is no exception in the history of the church. Examples could be multiplied if you read history closely. But I'd like to draw two lessons from this, two traps for our time, among the many traps for our time. We often observe conflict among traditional Catholics. We lament it. We become discouraged by it. But I think we should look to history for some lessons and for some consolation. The first trap for traditionalists, I think, is that of discouragement. I often say to people who are worried about conflicts that to be a good traditional Catholic, you have to have a skin like an armadillo. And perhaps to be a good traditional Catholic priest, you have to have a skin like a tank. Now, remember, conflicts and disagreements are the result of the fall of Adam, the result of our darkened intellects, of our weakened will, of our inclination toward what is called irascibility. We tend, because of our pride, to get very, very angry indeed. But we must be realists. We must face this fact of our wounded human nature. And we must realize that men of goodwill will sometimes disagree and will come to blows and conflict over questions which are matters of prudential judgment. We saw that in the dispute between the Jesuits and the seculars and between the abstinents and the ancients. Now, we look at history, though, we see the faith survived. We see the Mass survived. We see that the sacraments survived. It survived the Jesuit diocesan conflict in England. It survived the ancient and the abstinent conflict in France. It can survive us, too. It can survive us, too. So, in the face of the tragic discouragement, we must be consoled. The second trap is the trap of false authority. If there's one lesson among the many we can learn from history, it is that Catholics need authority over them. In our examples, the Catholics, technically speaking, had real authority over them, the authority of the Pope. But the Pope could not effectively exercise his authority because of the secular power in both England and France. In our own time, we have somewhat of an analogous situation. A hierarchy has defected from the faith, and as a result, have lost their authority. Hence, it is that conflicts will arise over matters of prudential judgment, over matters of theological opinion, which only a pope could resolve, invoking his authority. The one trap and the one temptation we have is to set up in one way or another a substitute for this authority of the Church in some person, in some prelate, or in some organization. But aiming to resolve conflicts this way, frequently we end up just creating more conflicts. I've experienced this, so have all of you. The effects of investing one person or organization with the substitute authority, the substitute for the real authority of the Church and the infallibility of the Pope. These named Lefebvre, Schuchart, Girard, Delorier, Kelly, or even in my own case especially, Chicada. Or be it substituting for authority by the SSPX, CMRI, SSPV, or CM, PCA, or any one of the other combinations of letters in the traditional alphabet soup. Remember, there is no substitute in any person or organization for the authority of the Pope and for the hierarchy he appoints to govern the Catholic Church. So if we must be consoled at the thought of history, we must also be warned. To conclude, what should we do? We should first of all, I think, take our consolation from history, realize that these things, these conflicts at least, have happened before. Secondly, we have to keep our eye on our heavenly goal. And thirdly, when disputes arise over matters of mere prudential judgment, let us please try to act with charity, with restraint. Fourthly, we must admit to ourselves at least that we can make mistakes and that we are not infallible. Still today, right, I would have sided against St. Vincent de Paul on the question of who was right, the ancients or the abstinents. I would have definitely sided with the ancients and would probably contend that he was a saint, but he was on the wrong side. We can think of other examples of that in history. Fifthly, we have to, in our zeal, try to avoid bitterness, the bitterness of a bitter zeal. And sixthly, we have to get on with the work of saving our souls and saving the souls of others. We look for an assessment and a warning, I think, to some words of Father Lacaille on the Cistercian conflict. Here's what he said of this whole 100-year-long conflict. For nearly all of the conflict's capable leaders were drawn into a consuming and yet barren fight for power. The best minds of three successive generations spent more time in planning legal strategy than in meditation, used up a greater amount of paper in writing defamatory pamphlets than in works of edification, spent longer hours sitting on court benches and choir stalls. Again, he says, it's a warning to us all. When the parties blinded by ever-rising passions were unable to settle among themselves what could not be hopeless, could not by hopelessly muddled court procedures be settled either. Barrels of ink spilled over acres of paper by restless pens have helped only posterity's curious historians, without contributing anything to the comfort of those who wielded them. Had the immense energy, time, talent, and financial sacrifice been used for the rebuilding of the moral and material foundations of the order, the movement would have had far happier results. In truth, even the acceptance of the final compromise was not the triumph of belated wisdom over inveterate prejudice, but rather the effect of opportunistic considerations on the part of the common servants and befuddled exhaustion on the part of the strict observance. The men who helped shape the destiny of the reform were fighting children of a fighting century. When they preferred force to persuasion, legal justice to charity, defiance to obedience, they fell into the same temptation that victimized most of their contemporaries. They were all activated by the unshaken conviction that anything less than battling with unflagging pertinacity to the last for his position would amount to a shameful betrayal of the holy cause. Their dispute now is one which is of interest only to historians. So too the conflict of the Wisbeach affair, the Wisbeach stirs in England between the Jesuits and the Diocesans. Perhaps the conflicts of our own time among traditionalists will end up the same way. In the meantime, we pray fervently that God, in these difficult times, will strengthen us with his might and endow us with patience and long-suffering, and somehow grant us a measure of his peace. Thank you.